Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And if you like, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This podcast is at the Rugby Dungeon. And of course, if you listen to Egg Chasers, you can follow us there at Rugby Podcast. Anyway, today I've got a very special guest calling in all the way from France, although it, really it should be Scotland, Sam Hidalgo-Klein. How are you, mate?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So what have you been up to today then?
Just a little bit of team run today. It's been a pretty miserable day here in Lyon, so I think it's meant to be a little bit nicer tomorrow for the game. So yeah, had a few things on. I've got the family arriving tomorrow, so I've got the panic clear up and trying to tidy the house up, change the bed.
Yeah, that must be pretty difficult because you've got a young family, right? And you've not had a long-term club now for a couple of years. So how are you managing that?
Well, it's the first time that I've actually been without the family. I've been without them for about 6 weeks now, so it's been quite tough having Christmas here and New Year on my own.
Yeah,
a couple of lads looked after me really well. But it, the Lyon side of things came around very last minute. So it was one of these things that I had to take because I was either out there playing or sitting about pretty much doing nothing. But to be honest, I've actually really enjoyed it here. It's been good. I've settled in well. Made some good close friends. A few of the lads have looked after me, and it'll be good. So, deciding whether the family will stay with me or not. But yeah, certainly got about a month and a half left of the contract. So,
who did you spend Christmas with, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, I was over at Liam Gill's house. Him and his sister were there. So his family, Court and the little one, have gone back to Australia. So he was there with his sister, and yeah, they looked after me.
Oh, nice. I've been lucky enough to interview Gilly on previous podcasts, and he's a good bloke.
Yeah, he's a great boy. Yeah, very good boy. We've gotten really well with each other, and there's a few of the other foreigners as well who have looked after me, so Fernsey and Tobes as well. So, been good so far.
Just on that one, I mean, if you're not an aficionado on the French league, but you tend to watch a lot of internationals, you might have remembered Liam Gill from about, I don't know, must be 5 years since he played for Australia last. But if you don't know him, a cracking seven. And actually, one of those sevens that if he was playing for any other country, probably would still be an international.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's an incredible player, especially when he's on form. He's unbelievable. I don't know what's happening with him at the moment. He's deciding, weighing up a few things at the moment, what his plans are to do. I'm not sure if he's looking to go back home to Australia or if he's looking to stay out. But yeah, he's certainly just, he's an incredible player who's done well over here in France, and we'll see what happens next with him, to be honest.
Tell me just a little bit about you at the moment then. Have you found yourself going from Worcester to Harlequins, then over to Racing, and then finally Lyon?
Yeah. Okay, so things fell through at Edinburgh when I was... so I currently had, you know, the whole thing that went on with Stella, with Matt, my agents, getting done for essentially betting on sports. So I was currently negotiating with Edinburgh, and they were looking to re-sign me. They offered me, but to be honest, I probably had a better years there, and they probably offered me a terrible contract for how well I was playing. So again, it came to the negotiation bit, which things fell through, and essentially they just said, look, because you've asked for more, whatever, you're gone, essentially. So that was me. And my agent at that point, I had to get rid of because he was done for betting and sport, and I didn't.
Oh, wow. I had no idea that was the case.
Yeah. So then I joined up with Tom Beattie, who's done really well for me, nice guy. He managed to get me a gig, but very late on down at Scarlets for 2 years.
Yeah.
And it's been to PVAC and John Daniels on the phone, and I had essentially just had a normal Skype call or FaceTime call, and essentially what they wanted from me, and what I was looking to get out of the club as well, and you know, the game plan essentially that I thought was in, that they were looking to do essentially kind of wasn't the game plan that when I got there was the case. The whole kicking kind of game just wasn't there. They tried it, it didn't work for them because they didn't have, they had quite a lot of injuries, and to be honest, they let go of a few key players, but they relied on getting turnovers. You're like, so John Barkley, you know, Ty Byrne. So they had it, and there's a centre, Scott Williams as well. So they had a few players that they were relying on the games to get turnovers, and then playing their counter-attackers, they were incredibly good at. But with James Davies out as well, through injury, they weren't really getting anyone, any turnovers, maybe won a game. So they did struggle from that sort of thing. So the game plan at the start of the season wasn't really working.
That's really interesting.
And they obviously had Gareth Davies there, they had Johnny Evans, and then a young boy, Kieran Hardy, who had already previously been at the club, went over to Jersey and came back, and he was actually playing quite well, and they gave him a run and he was going good. So it kind of just, it worked out that the game plan didn't work for me and it worked for them, and one of these things led to another, and after about 8 months, an opportunity to go up. So this was a two-year contract then, Mike. So
right. Well, hang on, let me just stop you there, because this is my own fault for asking such broad questions. You invariably find that there's so much information in the answer and then you want to dig a bit deeper. So just tell me about your agent, because, I mean, from a rugby point of view, from a rugby player's point of view, that's a disaster. Your job is to concentrate on the rugby, and then your agent's job, of course, is to concentrate on basically the professional side. Yeah. That must have come as a huge shock.
Well, it was one of these... I just actually left Red Sky, and I'd looked to get join Stellar,
yeah,
which was the name of the company, and I hadn't been with him long, and it turned out a lot of players, I think he did, you know, Yamaro Toji's, all these guys, they're a very big company, and I think they do football as well.
Yeah.
And I think actually most of those players stayed with them, but I was the only rugby player they had up in Scotland. I didn't really know much about them. I didn't know whether or not they could stay in the job. He was telling me he can do it, his brother will work for him, he just can't sign the paperwork, etc. But from my side of things, it was such a crucial time that I didn't really think, well, no club's going to want to speak to you if this has just come out in the papers. I found out from the papers, I then found out from him.
Oh.
So I'm asking these questions, he's kind of brushing it off, and it just didn't kind of sit well with me. I just felt like as a player... you want to hear it firsthand from your agent. Like, look, this is going to come out in the paper a couple of weeks later. Don't worry about it. It's been a misunderstanding, which it may have been. And I still probably don't really know the ins and outs of it. But it was such a crucial time for me during negotiations, which I'm sure any player can relate to.
Oh,
that you don't want this going on. And so, and I'd known Tom through my fiance. They went to university, and I'd obviously spoken to Tom for a little bit before, just from knowing him. And he was keen to have me on board, so I said, look, if you can get me a gig anywhere, then we can sit down and talk and look to join you. And in all fairness, he's done really well for me, got me Scarlets, got me the stuff over at Harlequins and Racing, so he's done brilliant for me, and obviously Leon now. So, that time, that was actually very late on in the season in terms of signing, because I was essentially going to be signing with Edinburgh. And I think they knew I just had a newborn kid.
Yeah.
I had the house. I was kind of in the back foot from the start because they knew my situation. It's, they leave it on late on, so you can't have any other options as well. So they kind of...
Do you know what? It's so funny you mention that, because I'm just putting pen to paper now. I'm going to be writing an article in the next few days about all the lads that are going to play for Wales but are from England.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things I find about it is... once you've played for Wales, you then get in this weird situation where the only people that can offer you a job are then the Welsh regions. So they know for a fact that they've got you and that you can't do anything about it. And if you look at someone like Lee Halfpenny, they wait till the very last second to get a deal done. Now, Lee Halfpenny, you know, maybe it's not that serious. Maybe he's earned lots of money in the past, which undoubtedly he has. But if you've got a young family and whatnot and you need your future sorted out sooner rather than later, these are really nervous times.
Yeah, massively, and I think clubs now know this. Now they've got a new system, because it was all happening when I was there in Wales, and they've bracketed every single essentially every person on different tiers. So if you're a British National Lion, you're between this bracket. This is the maximum and minimum that you can earn. If you're a, and if anything goes out with that, that has to essentially, I think, go to the board, and the club have to. Yeah, it's come a very tricky. There's some players, you know, who may have had really good contracts that were above themselves, or vice versa. It's helped some players that felt like they were hard done by, and it's gone to the board. So it's kind of evened themselves out. It's probably not a bad system, but it just means that every region knows what bracket you're in, so you can never compete really against other regions. It's quite a difficult one.
It is, yeah. Did you find that the fact that you were a newly minted Scotland international at the time didn't actually play in your favour?
Well, I think because I was so late on, I was always in the back foot from the start because you know, like if you're doing a negotiation late on, they know, well, most clubs have already sorted their main scrum halves, you know?
Yeah.
So you're going as to compete for number one, but they know that you're the only option for the player, so they can essentially lowball you or do whatever. I didn't feel like I was hard done by or anything by Scarlett, so I just think the timing of everything was
sure
wasn't great because of the situation at Edinburgh. For sure.
Interesting. So if you were to talk to, say, a young player now coming through the ranks, how would you advise him to filter out agents?
It's a hard one because,
isn't it?
I've stepped into a couple of my own negotiations before, and it's a really difficult one because I feel like the clubs always have the upper hand now, especially in this game, because clubs will essentially hold you to the last moment, or they'll know your situation. They know everything that's going on, and they know what clubs need what. And unless you're a current top international, you're not going to be pushing the boundaries for essentially cash if that's what you're after or whatever. It's certainly unsettling because, you know, you can be shortlisted in so many different clubs, but you're never guaranteed until it's over the white line. Until it's written on paper, it's very nerve-wracking for youngsters, essentially, but also people with families, as you say. It's not a nice time to be involved, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think people understand really what rugby payment is like. You're absolutely correct there. If you're not a top-class international, I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but a lot of the lads who are playing, say, in the Premiership, they're somewhere between 100 and probably 120 to 150 on average, but more likely to be on something more like 80 grand. People don't realise, outside of the top players, it is a real job.
Yeah, for sure, and especially with the salary caps being hammered just now, it's, you know, the things that are going on down south, it's essentially just like a well-paid normal job, unless you are that top international or you're making your money from international games, you know, the bonuses from there, so...
Yeah, and it is a funny one because as soon as you're an international, not only do you get your club money, and the international money is obviously worth a lot of money, but then you start getting all the endorsements in too. So it just sort of compounds and compounds and compounds.
Yeah, it does. It does. But certainly, I think with the endorsements, you've got to be playing international for a long time before you're looking at any of these endorsements, or certainly at the top level for a decent period of time. You know, bar maybe boots getting thrown at you, it can be difficult to get endorsements thrown your way if you're new in the scene or you've not got many caps.
So just tell me a little bit more about the Scarlets, and why was it then you didn't feel that your style of play necessarily fitted in with what they wanted to do, and also as a nine, what are you looking to do?
Well, for me, a big thing for me is like my kicking game. Scarlets and Torsi, and in fairness to them, they won the league 2 years previous, or the year previous to me arriving. The way they played, you know, they were getting turnovers.
Yeah.
They were scoring off everything. They were holding the ball from everywhere. They weren't kicking much. And I think they were looking to adapt that by bringing me in. They were looking to have, you know, kick corners more, looking at playing off nine. They tried it when we went over to Edinburgh. We tried all the box kicks and the contested balls, and instead of kicking off 10, looking at off nine. And it just didn't work, to be honest. We weren't winning the area battle, we weren't going out for the kicks. The coach had just read, sat back and went, "No, we're going straight back to what we were used to," sort of thing. And it just kind of unfolded from there, to be honest. After that, game time just changed a little bit, giving other players opportunities. They were playing well and fitness to them. And that's kind of the way rugby goes. Unless you get your chance and you take it,
And I guess it's a funny situation because Scarlets are the exception rather than the rule, particularly then, because they were playing this weird brand of rugby, which I think I'm right in saying no one else really plays like Scarlets. Yet, coincidentally, box kicking scrum halves have become more and more valuable, probably the last 2-3 years.
Massively. I think the game is hugely going towards kicking off line mainly. Box kicks are crucial. If you look at how the Irish play, everything's off box kicks and contestables, but the aerial battle, if you can win that, it's like a game of chess rugby. I think it's there's time and place to just have a crack from anywhere and just and throw it around, but you need to have a smart kicking game as well.
And why do you think rugby is going that way?
I just think it is, to be honest. I just think it's very predictable of 10. If you pull a bad 10, he's sitting in the pocket, your winger straight away drop off. Nine's got his hands on the ball, he's always a threat, whether or not he's running or he can pin it in the corner. I just think nines have such a key role in the game these days. When I used to play 10, it was probably more from 10. Nines that weren't kicking in much or doing the little toppies into the corner as much. It was generally off 10.
Yeah.
But certainly now you see it a lot. Nines are becoming very nippy around the breakdown. Or if they tighten up there, then you play up to the 10 and they put a lot of crossfields in. And certainly, don't get me wrong, there's still a lot of kicking from the 10, certainly crossfield kicking, but more from exits, I would definitely say. You're looking at scrum halves exiting more often.
Yeah, so to be fair, I didn't realise what an effect a scrum half could have on a game. I mean, I've played the game for a few years now. I watch it an awful lot. But it wasn't until I watched Faf de Klerk live in the flesh over a period of games you realise exactly what a good kicking scrum half can do. And people don't even think of him as a kicking scrum half, but actually it does that incredibly well. And the effect it has is absolutely enormous.
Yeah, it's massive. He's been on form as well. And if you look at someone like Will Genya, for example, the old toppies that he used to do in the corner are just so effective. It's just turns teams, it constantly turns wingers, and it just puts stress on the back three. Because if you're playing back three, as soon as a nine passes to 10, the winger will naturally just start dropping back.
Yes.
As soon as it's at nine, he's got to stay high because he's worried about the short side, and if the thing's not covering that corner, there's a lot of space. So it's, you've got to have a good balance, and I think a good scrum half will have a good balance, but someone like Faf, I think, has nailed it. At the moment he's doing very well. He's obviously a big running threat, but he's got a good kick on him as well. So
yeah, the only thing I'd say, I think sometimes when we get it a little bit wrong with the box kicking is when we have those massive elongated rucks, because in my mind one of the best parts of it, you mentioned Will Genya before, the opposition are expecting the pass, they get the kick, it's absolutely devastating. But with the whole elongated ruck thing, I think a lot of the advantage of the box kick is negated because we know it's coming because there's 8 men stood at the back of the ruck.
No, you're right. And I probably spent quite a few years at Edinburgh doing it, to be honest. We spent any time in our own half.
Yeah.
You watch Munster, they do it constantly. If you're sitting in your own half, any time, it's just a no-risk game. It's just any time the ball touches your half, you find the 15, you set up a box kick, you have to rely on your wingers getting up in there, and if they don't win it, then you can struggle. But if they win it, you're on the front foot. And certainly, teams generally start dropping back. As soon as you set that up, they start dropping back. So it does become more difficult, but the only good thing is it allows you to have the players right across the board in the positions that you want. So Edinburgh, for example, they were very, very... They always were. As soon as somebody kicked us, you'd go to a 15, you'd have the 8 carrying or the back row, because once you've set that ruck up, he sits in the backfield and waiting to receive an Xbox kick from them with a kick. You'd have your 3 players in the 15 that would be chasing, and then you'd have your full back line. So they were very, very strict on how they set up their box kick any time they're on half.
Really?
And players on it. And Saracens probably do the same, I'm sure. They're massive on setting up an exit well. And it just becomes a no-risk game where it's just... But there's a huge emphasis on winning that ball back, and I guess it's taking your time to execute as well to make sure it's on the money and not risk. Because nowadays, if you mess up a kick or it's too long and you've got somebody in the backfield who's electric, you can be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
If your front line aren't flat or if they're separated, you can be in a lot of trouble. So it's probably just trying to take that risk out of the game, but I do agree at times it can be certainly boring to watch. But
I guess it requires understanding, because if you think kicking's boring, I think people want to try and watch a game without kicking and then 15 defenders, because that would be really, really boring. And I just don't think people appreciate the nuance of kicking and why you're doing it enough, really.
Yeah, no, no, massively. And to be honest, I enjoy the side of kicking game where I say rugby is essentially like a game of chess. It's massive ebb and flow. You're essentially kicking until somebody messes up. It's like any sport. You're just transferring the pressure and hopefully you're relying on them to execute the next skill. And if they mess it up, then that's when you light up and you can have a crack. And they're doing the same to you. They're kicking back to you because they're waiting for you to run at the wrong time or to kick it, you know, and not be effective with the kick at the wrong time. So people don't understand it. They think, oh, you're just kicking the ball away. But there's a reason why they're kicking and where they're kicking and what they're doing. And I think unless you've played it, the sport or whatever, or you understand that side of the game, then it's obviously difficult to understand. But if you know it, it can be exciting at times as well.
Even if you do understand, there are nuances. So I was lucky enough to interview a Premiership fullback. Chris Pennell. And he was explaining that sometimes line up close to the defensive line, so it looked like he wasn't expecting the kick, to bait them into the kick so he could then drop back. So there's actually games within games, like showing people the wrong look in order to make sure that they do kick.
Yeah, 100%. It's all the time. You know, one thing I look at is when we're playing from a touchline, say you scrum half, for example, if I'm playing from the touchline, we play into the middle. Straight away, I've got my eyes on what the 15's doing, and if the 15 goes to the middle of the pitch but the winger's not dropped back, you generally get a nice little wee corner window.
Yeah.
That where nines will look to put that kick in straight away. But 15s will sometimes play with you, and as soon as you go down to pick the ball up, they've covered back or the winger's dropped back in that position.
I bet.
And they'll deliberately show you a different picture, and as soon as you go to do it, the picture's changed by the time you've got up to kick. Yep. And it happens all the time. It takes literally a split second for them to change the picture. But in that split second, your head's in the ruck picking the ball up, and as you know it, you've already kicked the ball straight down their throat, and they're halfway down the pitch, or they're putting the kick down, and you're back in your 22. So
yeah, what a nightmare. So your good decision has instantly become a bad decision?
Oh, massively. Massively. It happens all the time. All the time, and it's just knowing, I guess that comes with analysis, but also knowing, not trying to do it every single time you get an opportunity, but just knowing the player as well and who does it. You generally get to know who does it in the games and who don't, but and when you've really caught someone out and what space you've got to work with.
Yeah, so do you get any help from your fly half there? Because I imagine he knows that you're going to kick it. Now, if he didn't want to help you, you'd just stay away. But if he did want to help you, I guess he's got to cancel that pretty quickly to get, you know, to get his hands onto the ball.
Well, for that kick specifically, they won't know we're kicking that. That's like an instinctive, I've seen a bit of space.
Ah, right, yeah.
At the same time, he's probably seen the same space and is calling it as well. So it's just whether or not who takes the kick, essentially. He may have seen other space out wide or whatever, but generally a lot of time you see the same space because you're always looking around. It generally happens around that halfway 40 metre line when you're trying to put them into their own corner. So you've seen generally the same space and you're both calling it, to be honest.
When you're doing your extras then, is kicking one of the things which you're particularly practising?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Box kicks are always something you've got to work on. Just trying to put yourself under pressure as well, just doing different drills to keep working on it. It's never easy when you've got a big second row, and that's probably comes back to the point of why they do that long essentially snake to box kick as well, is to get away from the pressure, make it as easy as possible for you. But yeah, something you've got to obviously practice as much as possible.
What did you make of the complaints from... It wasn't from Conor Murray himself, but it was from, I think, the Irish press, that teams have started targeting his standing leg. Is that a thing?
I don't know if it's a thing. I think it's a thing, you know, it's one of these things that essentially, even when I used to play derby games, you know, you after every kick, part of their whole plan would get the nine on the ground, just get them on the ground as much as possible. And if you're looking at the... I don't really know if that's a thing or not, but ideally you want to be getting the ball, but obviously if you can't get the ball, you're looking to get the scrum half on the ground as much as possible. And just know that your influence, you're always there, you're pressuring him, he's not got an easy kick, and that one time it might just make him go off his stance or kick it too quick and he's kicked it too long. It's just, I guess, it's one of these things where you just got to let them know that you're there.
So, for instance, like you've never heard them round the ruck saying, you know, target the foot or foot, or, you know, there's no particular call for it. Because I actually have seen a team train in that manner previously.
It's never happened to me, but at the same time, you're always kind of worrying about your own natural kick that you kind of blank everything out, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. In your mind, then, what is the perfect length of a box kick for competing? Do you have this kind of range in your mind where you want to be landing it?
Well, everyone says it's what, between 22 to 23 meters, and it's about 4 second hang time, should they say.
Is that right?
It just depends on really the wingers you have, how quick they are. You want to be contesting in the air.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't really want them to be coming down and then hitting them. A lot of wingers wait till they come down and then they tackle them. But for me, that's essentially pointless. Because unless you're winning that ruck, which very rarely happens,
yeah,
you want to be in there at least tapping the ball back or somehow making it really difficult for them.
So your skill as a nine, or one of your many skills, I should say, as a nine, is the box kick. So you show up at one of your new clubs. Is it a thing that you grab hold of a winger and you explain to him exactly where he needs to be and when he needs to be there, and when you're going to do extras later, maybe he should hang about?
Generally, at the end of every session, the wingers will always ask for a few kicks anyway.
Yeah.
So it's just one of these things where normally we'll just kick to them and they'll catch it. And sometimes they'll come on our side and they'll chase a few. And you generally just naturally get the timing off each other, but it's, you know, roughly how far you want to put it. If you can get it just over 20 metres, just under 25, you know, you're in a good position that anybody's going to be able to get under that ball without stressing themselves too much, that they can slow down and actually get up for it. So, yeah, you generally do work on with the wingers all the time.
You go from Edinburgh to Scarlets. Obviously, they're both Pro 14 teams. And then you find yourself, well, did you go to Worcester first, or did you go to Harlequins?
Harlequins, yeah. No, I've not been to Worcester, just Harlequins.
Oh, I thought you had for some reason. So you ended up at Harlequins. Did you feel a different sort of attitude towards the game when you went to the Premiership?
Yeah, I did, because before going there, I had no interest in going to the Premiership at all. I always just felt like it was very forward oriented. I didn't think I was going to enjoy it.
That's interesting.
It sounds ridiculous, but I didn't actually really want to go to the Premiership ever. And I'm actually glad I have, because massively it's changed. I actually really enjoyed Harlequins. One of my favourite clubs I've been to, even though it was just for a small stint.
Yeah.
Thought the setup was great. The team were good. The boys were great. The staff were incredible. Just very different. It is the forwards are bigger. It is, in the winter months, going to be forward orientated. But they do play as well. I feel like there's more of a buzz to it than maybe the Pro 14. The Pro 14
people
get the fans that maybe it deserves. Or bar obviously the big derby games, or if you go over to Ireland. But certainly there's more fans at every game in the Prem, I find. And every game seems to be like a really tough game, and I think that maybe comes to the relegation. You know, in the Pro 14, they used to be essentially, you know, Treviso are now doing well, but you would always say, oh, we've got the Italians this week, it's not going to be as hard, it's not as tough as, you know, if you go away to Newcastle or something, which I could imagine being very difficult, because they're fighting it every single week for, you know, being promoted or staying up or not being relegated. So, you know, if you came bottom in the Pro 14, okay, yeah, it's very disappointing and it's not great, but you're still there next year, whereas these other teams aren't. And I think that's where these games where you would maybe look to rotate in the Pro 14, your team, you probably can't do it as much in the Premiership, which makes it difficult.
So I just want to dig into those comments a little bit more. Yeah, it's interesting that you didn't want to go to the Premiership, or it wasn't really one of the things that you were thinking about. Because as a spectator of rugby, I look at the two products, the one given to us by Pro 14, one given to us by the Premiership. And frankly, I just love watching the Premiership. I love the energy and the intensity of it. Do you think I'm probably missing something then, by the way that I'm viewing rugby? Maybe I should be paying more attention to the Pro 14.
No, you know, the reason why I say that is when I was at Edinburgh and we used to play against the European sides, you know, your Bordeaux, your these kind of sides, I always wanted to play in France from being 2021 playing for Edinburgh. I always said, I just love the way they play, the attitude, kicking from half, you know, the kick goals.
Yeah.
The, you know, completely different mindset, you know, the Pro 14, the 10 runs a game, probably the same in the Premiership, but out in France, it's more certainly the scrum halves. And I just enjoy the way, the flair that they have. It's just, you know, yeah, they do make mistakes and they throw offloads, but it's almost like they don't care. They just, they want to have a crack. And it's different to how I perceived it initially. Now that I've been here, it's certainly different. There's huge pressures that come with it. But, yeah, I don't know why. I just felt like, I always thought the Premiership was very much forward driven. It was just kind of like gritting out games. It was a difficult league, and you know, every time you turn on the TV in top green, it seemed like it's sunny and everyone's throwing the ball around wide, and it was just, it looked like a good league to be in. And you know, there's so many superstars across the board here. But yeah, for me, I always felt like, oh, I definitely want to be over there.
But there again, if you feel that the English packs in the Gallagher are big, I mean, you must think that these guys in the top 14 are enormous.
Yeah, some guys are, yeah, for sure. If you go to the Toulon side, for example, they're enormous. It kind of, it's funny though, because you get used to, you know, when your players are matching their players for the physicality.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's not me that has to make these tackles. Yeah, okay, I will do a few of them, and you see some like Tuusova, for example, it's ridiculous. You wouldn't get that in the Pro 14.
He is, isn't he?
Just different level. You just don't see that, and it's funny because you just get used to it. It's weird. I think when your team can match another team, it kind of just levels itself out. It's not like it's your side are small. When we used to play in Europe and you'd go up against French sides, you really notice the difference. But when you're actually in France and you're leveling it out, you don't notice it as much. So it's slightly different, but yeah, certainly some of these guys are huge. It's ridiculous. I would say rugby would be easy when you're that size.
So I guess you identify far more with the French style of nine play than probably anywhere else then?
I've enjoyed it, but obviously just doing small stints, the World Cup joke over at Racing, it's hard because one, I didn't speak a single word of French before I went there, and also the language is very difficult.
Yes, I bet.
It's not an easy language learn at all, and when you're only there for such a short period of time, trying to learn that language when you're actually trying to learn players and new systems and get to know people, it's not easy. So I think this time round's been a little bit easier than Racing because I've got a few more words, a few more phrases. I know how things work a little bit, and I've settled in pretty quickly, and the team have gone quite well, to be fair. So the pressures are different.
Yeah. Now, did you manage to visit the Racing wine cellar?
Yeah. So Jackie's got his own. When you go into, so he's part of three. I think he owns two chateaus and maybe shares or one other.
Yeah.
And when you go into the reception, he's got the pictures of the three. He's got big bottles there. And yeah, downstairs you can buy the wine, and he brings it in from Bordeaux. But yeah, he's got some wine stocked downstairs. Yeah, and over in the restaurant as well, he's got stuff that you can buy and have for lunch as well.
That's incredible stuff.
Are unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. I don't ever think I'll see a stadium like that in rugby ever. Not for a long, long time.
Yeah, because Racing are, I mean, if you think about French rugby, they are very, very French. I know they've got some English speakers there, yada, yada, yada. But actually, you know, the way they play, the style of play, the offloading, I don't even know how you coach the offloading game which they play. It seems uncoachable. They are quintessentially a team that play like the French national team should play.
Yeah, no, they are an awesome side, and essentially now that they had all the World Cup players back, the likes of Finn, Vakitawa, you know, Terry Tom was already there, but he's on fire now at the moment. Like, these guys are just—they just click. They've got so much flair about them. Finn does so well for them in the sense that he just he just creates so much for them, and they've got so much individual brilliance across the board. They're just back on form. They're just playing so well. And that pitch is, it just suits them to a tee. It gets very, very hot and sweaty in there.
Yep.
So the ball's very hardly dry. I think it's always set at like 22 degrees, so it becomes very, very sweaty.
How is it?
Everyone gets fooled by it because they think it's going to be perfect dry ball.
Yeah.
I know the conditions are great, but it gets very hot in there. when you're running around, for sure. But it's such a good pitch. Incredible stadium, good setup. The aftermatch stuff is awesome for all the fans involved.
Tell me about the aftermatch stuff, because I actually saw Nick Mullins tweeting about there's a bar on the, basically underneath the sticks, right?
So you got this. You got the big screen at one end, which is ridiculous, by the way.
It's an absolute.
But they call it the bodega, and it's a live band. The play, and at the end of the game, so they got all the lights going and everything. It's like a nightclub essentially. Game, they bring the bodega stretched out to the try line, and everybody from the stands goes down to the bodega where they have a couple of bars down there.
I just can't see this being a good idea for the life of me.
And the lights are just going as if it's, because it's obviously set up for concerts, they've got just incredible lights everywhere. Even at halftime, you come out and it's live music, the lights are off, and it's just like, it's like a nightclub. It's awesome.
It is. It is amazing. But I still can't get over the fact that, you know, behind the try line, they've got a bar, and you've got drunk people spilling alcohol. I mean, do they put some, I know this sounds really, really boring now, but they must put some sort of protective layer down onto the pitch. You can't be playing on bottle tops and whatnot.
Well, they've got behind the end of the dead ball line, they've got like a different ground, if that makes sense.
Oh, have they?
Well, it's like a kind of semicircle, I'm pretty sure it is. I can't even remember now. But the live band is slightly extended, so they've got the barrier and then they've got the live band behind it, and people can sit there. I don't know if there's different packages for game day or whatever, but there's people there whenever we're warming up. And then at the end, people come down. So I don't know how accessible it is during the game. But certainly after, everybody comes down there, and they do extend it. They don't put a different layer down, to be honest, on the dead ball area.
Could only happen in France.
It's unbelievable. If you ever get a chance, you have to go over. It is incredible.
What were you guys doing post game then? Because I go over to like the AJ Bell Stadium quite a lot, and you always see the players mingling afterwards. Do you guys go down there and mingle, or have you got like corporate stuff?
Nah, so we'll go upstairs and we'll have food. And everybody has to go upstairs and have food. Jackie, the president, wants all the players to, you know, if somebody wants a picture with the player, they can have it, any of the sponsors or whoever, and we'll sit with the other team. Then we'll go through. If you can continue on, basically the families are essentially in the president suite, which is basically Jackie's big box, which is above the bodega, and the families are there, so you'll see your families. They expect everybody to go down and show face in the bodega after.
Yeah.
So everyone that's hammered or drunk and they're parting away and they're coming up getting pictures, or if you win a game, you go down for a few drinks as well. And it's a very good setup, and I think they had to make it good because where the stadium is, it's out of town essentially. So it's, you've got to do something where it brings people to the games, and they're actually enjoying it. You know, they're not.
Yeah.
Kind of stay there, if that makes sense. And the thing is, it's awesome because you can't tell. It could be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, bright sunny, but it's pitch dark inside. You have no idea what time. You don't know what time it is at all. So you can properly enjoy yourself from the get-go, essentially, if you're a fan. But it's an incredible setup. The facilities they have, even at the training ground, are a joke. Right across.
I mean, if you look at the stadium, I can only imagine. What do you make of this crop of French nines then? Because, you know, you're in an expert position to comment on this. You see him every week, and also you trained with one in Machinot, although maybe he's not in this crop of nines.
Yeah. Of the French nines in the World Cup squad? The Six squads. Well, I don't know too much about the Bordeaux nine. I know, obviously, Jan plays a fair bit for them, so they've clearly just gone with a squad that's incredibly young, looking at the next World Cup, and that's their goal. And to be honest, as harsh as it sounds, it will probably benefit them.
Yeah,
in 4 years' time. But you may not see the results for a couple of years, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, yeah, they've gone with the young Bordeaux guy. I mean, they've still got lads in there like Dupont and Sarin who are still relatively young. I mean, Dupont's only about 21, is he not?
Yeah.
And he's absolutely electric.
To be honest, I was actually shocked to not see Sebastian Bezzé in there. I think he's been going incredibly well for Toulouse. Just every week, he's a very good player. I think he's awesome. So I was surprised to see him not involved, whether or not they'll bring him in even just in the training squad or what they'll do. But they've certainly just said, essentially, for Machinon, he's not going to make the next World Cup, or they don't see him for the future. So cut loose now, sort of thing. And it's a bit of a shame for these players who are on the cusp of that late 20s, because they think they can maybe get another World Cup, or certainly can get another World Cup, but they're obviously looking at much more of the future.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if he wants an opportunity to change that, he's in the perfect place at Racing, particularly if he gets more games and more exposure.
Yeah, for sure. But you know what, it's funny, because I can see rugby going that way. Certainly, now with the youngsters coming through, they're just incredible athletes. They're getting so much more opportunity that I actually do think players around that late 20s, 30 mark are going to be really struggling to get the same game time that they're looking at, or even certainly international call-ups when you've got the youngsters coming through.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I have this debate with my friends all the time. Is it worth setting up your international squad right now for 4 years' time, or do you just be national squad to win the next game? I don't really know what the answer is.
Well, it's a hard one, isn't it? Because they've just changed their coach. So they've obviously sat down and said, well, it's a four-year plan. If you go well in the next World Cup, essentially, we'll keep you on. And he must have just said, right, well, that's it, we'll just start now. I mean, Sean Edwards in there, I could see them actually going very well. As long as they all buy into the defence side of things, they could go incredibly well. But it is very bizarre. It's probably the only team that I've actually looked to properly do it or make that many changes.
Yeah, and from where you're sat then, I mean, do you think it's a shrewd appointment? Do you think that the French players can buy into someone like Sean Edwards? Because I always think that the French teams need to be coached by a Frenchman, because they're the only ones that really understand what's going on there.
It's a difficult one, and maybe this is why they've got youngsters in as well. It's kind of change of an era, essentially. It's, you know, these youngsters are probably a little bit more adaptive. They're listening more. The French ways have changed slightly. It's hard. I think they can, but I've seen just moments of madness from them. They're just doing something crazy, even if the World Cup, something small like that. I think they will. Naturally, defensively, they'll go well. It's just, all in all, they'll stick to the system. It's just whether or not one moment of madness, somebody will jump out or do something different that could sing on. That's the only thing.
Yeah, or if they have the standard French Revolution come every World Cup, like they seem to do every World Cup.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Just on the age of players. I mean, I also think that's curious as well, because there is a clamour for younger players, and I'll be the first to admit I dive on this bandwagon all the time. You know, I'll be the first one shouting for Lewis Rhys-Zammit to play for Wales or whatnot. But there is a certain quality that comes with age, and particularly at halfback too. I mean, I don't think you can get tens unless they physically can't do it anymore. I think tens and probably nines actually just improve with age, because it's about situational awareness and having seen everything.
Yeah, certainly the experience comes with that. The only thing I would say is nowadays with the modern age game is the fitness levels of scrum halves. You just got to be ridiculous. Like, if you want to be a top international scrum half, you have to be incredibly fit. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, youngsters are generally probably fitter than you're looking at people who are in their late 20s. You know, they have the making of being essentially a good scrum half. Yeah, they don't have the experience yet, but if you can expose these guys to good quality game time early doors, then there's no reason why they can't be pushing these players through and trying to get the best of them for years to come, rather than waiting until they're mid-20s and maybe getting 3-4 years and then looking at the next person coming through. So, but you're right in saying, like, at times there's certainly experience comes with it. You know, look at someone like Brock James, who's still...
Oh, yeah, he's still going.
But yeah, exactly, you know, and they use him because of his experience. He knows what happens in games. It's easy to unfold. He just pins him in the corners, knows when to pass. So from that side of things, absolutely, you need that experience. But the youngsters are now having more a different running game, more of a threat. It's not so much like a balanced game rugby, essentially. They're just really having a crack. They want, everything is about tempo, speed of ruck, how quickly people are set. It's just becoming almost like a rat race. It's becoming like a crazy game where it's just all about speed.
Do you know
who wins around the corner and the speed of ball and how quick it's happening?
Do you know what? I think you're probably exactly right there, because I was about to say people like props as well as fly halves tend to, you know, mature later because of the experience and all the scrimmaging. But actually, if you look at the props that are emerging now, yeah, you know, the scrimmaging's, yeah, of course it's important, but actually it's the ball carrying. It's the ball carrying, the explosivity, getting through the work rate, the tackles, and, you know, it's all that stuff, really.
Yeah, look at Sink over at Harlequins, Carl Sinclair.
Yeah.
He's not an old lad, he's my age, but he's probably deemed as one of the best props at the moment in the world.
I'd agree.
Explosive, he's quick, he can throw the ball. Yeah, okay, you'll throw a silly offload at times, but it's changed now where props can now pass. Before, they didn't have to pass. You know, their job was to literally scrum in the day and make good defensive shots, but now they're all over the shop. They've got to be explosive. They're essentially just big Lucys.
Yeah, well, I remember watching, I can't remember who they were playing, but Leinster were playing, and they went blind. And the three players that went blind is scrum half, and it went something like prop hooker prop or prop hooker or something like that. It doesn't really matter. The point was that they had their whole front row going blind. I thought, actually, that used to not happen, but now it can happen. It's absolutely devastating. Because imagine if you're a winger, scrum half, and a centre defending those three. You've got no chance.
Yeah. Oh, massively. I just don't think, obviously, set piece is still huge, but it's just, people want to play, it's all about like set piece now, just trying to get into your shape, you know?
Yeah.
As soon as you're in your shape, that's really where you're making the yards, because it's so levelled out now. I think it's, mauls don't go, yeah, mauls can stop mauls now. Scrums is such a lottery that actually teams, unless you're really dominant, sometimes don't want scrums. They just want to get the ball in and out.
Oh, absolutely.
Either way, before it was, if you had a dominant scrum, we'll take the scrum off a penalty, we'll get the yellow card, they're down to 14, and we'll go corner and maul them over. You know, now that's changed.
I think it will revert back, though, because these things always tend to revert back. You know, the more people don't take the scrum seriously, for instance, Australia went to a stage of not taking it seriously, and then they ran into PWNL. Is it PWNL? I got it right. WPNL. Thank you very much. And they get absolutely destroyed. So these things do go around in circles. But yeah, I think fundamentally you're right. You know, scrimmaging used to be vital. Now it's just adequate.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. But certainly, I think players now across the whole board have to have the skill set that they can throw the ball around pretty accurately as well.
So now you find yourself at Lyon, a fairly crazy couple of years for you. How do you think that you've developed as a player going to all these different environments?
You know what? I actually, in hindsight, probably wouldn't have changed much. I've loved my experiences that I've had over at the, since leaving Edinburgh, at the three clubs, and made good friends, learnt a hell of a lot both on and off the pitch, but myself as a person. I've actually really, really enjoyed it. The experiences on the pitch are not easy, because you're chucked into teams which you don't know anybody really, maybe one player at each club or a couple of players, if that. At the moment I'm surrounded by players who speak French. Chucked into a team in such a key role where I essentially have to be speaking the whole time, but also play and dictate things. So you learn a lot, and you learn and you rely on your experiences as a player in that role, but certainly you got to adapt to a different style of rugby. You know, you're going from the Pro 14 to the Premiership to Top 14, so essentially I've experienced all this side of the world, and it's incredibly valuable to have those experiences, which many other players don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd never choose it. I guess, you know, most rugby players say, give me a couple of clubs and let's keep nice and stable and develop way. But now you've got it, I imagine it's an incredible tool to be able to call upon.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was leaving Edinburgh, I was very scared to leave. Edinburgh was my home. I had all my friends. I didn't really know anyone down in Wales. You know, you're going down, most of the boys are all Welsh players. You know, they all play internationally. Like, it was a good big club. Pretty daunting to go to, but once you get there, you actually realise they're just rugby guys, they're all nice lads, you're pretty welcome. Like, they're welcoming And from there, I was like, well, why can't I go to Quinn's, you know, try that, experience that. I wasn't enjoying it as much as I would have liked at Scarlett's. Mm. Let's try that. And then the Leon thing just popped up very last minute, which I had to take because it just says, keeps me on the market playing and keeps me fit. So, like, I've certainly enjoyed it. But at the same time, even going to each of these clubs, you realise that you can implement things, you know, in a French game where it's just chaotic. You can implement, you know, how to control games and when they need a little bit of control, because sometimes they're not very good at it. You know, they might be able to offload incredibly well or play from 122, but they might not be able to close out a game as well. Or, you know, these small things where you might experience in the Prem or in the Pro 14 that they don't in the Top 14 and vice versa, I think it's been very good.
So, if you don't mind me asking, what deal are you on for Leon now? And are you looking to spend the rest of the season here and then get extended? Or are you just saying, this is going to be me for now, and then go elsewhere afterwards?
No. So I know I won't be extended over here. They have three scrum halves already. I was covering one of the scrum halves who did his hamstring for 3 months. So my deal is very much just 3 months and then head back home. And I'm just at the moment speaking to a few clubs. So I'll be looking to sign something pretty soon and just go from there, really. But just enjoying my time as much as possible here.
Yeah.
Play as far as I can and just keep them as, you know, they're sitting in second at the moment, but just try and get them back up to where they want to be at first and just try and win as many games and keep improving myself, to be honest. That's a big thing for me. And just at the same time, it's keeping me fit for essentially next season and going into wherever I go.
Any chance of seeing you in Super Rugby? I mean, that'd be a pretty cool move to round it all off.
You know what? I've not really thought about Super Rugby at all. It's not something that's really crossed my mind, just because it's far away. It's, you know, my little boy's two now. If I go over there, then it just can become complicated with schooling and things and the family. It'd be good to have family around him. So at the moment, it's not really something that's crossed my mind. If you asked me maybe a few years ago when I was coming out of Edinburgh, I would have probably jumped to that opportunity. And obviously, you know, seeing the likes of Joe Marchment going over there and us speaking to him about him going over to the Blues, you know, it does kind of like trigger that, be an incredible experience. But I don't know. I think Super Rugby is just kind of, I don't want to say it's dying, because it's certainly not, but it's a lot of those players are coming this side of the world, and it's probably just, if it was closer, maybe an opportunity, but I think it's just too far for me, to be honest.
Excellent. And lastly, any word from Scotland? Are they keeping in touch?
Yeah, they keep in touch. I spoke to Mike the other day. to be honest, for me, it's one of these things that just, I've probably not played enough consistently enough to be able to put my hand forward. It's not that I'm not playing well enough or anything. It's more just actually physical game time. So who knows what happened? I'm certainly still in touch with them, and obviously with Greg retiring, you know, anyone can put their hand up. We'll see what happens next year. We'll see what happens next year. If I continue to play well here and then wherever I go next year, we'll see if that opens or not. But certainly I got to worry about more enjoying myself at club level and playing well and just having confidence and trying things again. And then if that happens, it happens.
Well, personally, I hope we see you in the Premiership, but we will see what happens. Sam, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. Where can we find you on social media? Are you a prevalent tweeter?
You know what? I've been logged out of Twitter for about 4 months, I think. I actually don't even know how to get back on. So. Twitter. I'm on Instagram as well. I don't use social media huge amounts at the moment, but trying to stay off it. But I will get myself back on Twitter and somehow speak to them and try and get logged back in.
Fantastic. Sam, thank you so much. It's much appreciated, and we should do this again soon.
Yeah, Tom, man. Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.